Thanks, Gus. He always puts me first because I pack the room. No, I'm sure there's going to be some more people filtering in, but 8 a.m. is kind of a tough time slot. I am going to talk about the impact of neonicotinoids on pollinators, specifically mostly honeybees, but not exclusively. And we've talked about this at the control conference last year. In fact, last year Gus declared war on about everybody, got a lot of press about it. But we're going to talk and kind of review what we published since that time and then talk about some of the new developments and new research efforts that we have going on. Now, I'm sure almost everybody in the room is very aware that honeybees and pollinators are a major, major issue right now. They're getting a lot of press. Beginning about 2006, there's essentially this new malady described called colony collapse disorder, or CCD. And there's been a lot of research and speculation about what's causing this decline, this kind of rapid decline in some honeybee colonies. You know, most people place the number one blame on varroa mites and the diseases transmitted by varroa mites. But there are other diseases. There's management issues because a lot of this is being observed with managed colonies that are being moved around the countries in large country in large numbers to pollinate crops. But if you read the press and read the literature, the number one factor that rises to the top and catches all the blame is pesticides, and specifically neonicotinoids. And several years ago, really, when we started doing this research, the primary thing being targeted was neonicotinoid seed treatments in particular, and the issue of planter dust and talc emissions from vacuum planters. You know, these neonics are widely used for a number of reasons. One is they have low vertebrate toxicity, so they're very friendly to the user. They're systemic, they persist, and obviously they provide some efficacy or we wouldn't be using them. And they're very easy to adopt, but they are very widely used. In the Mid-South, virtually 100% of our cotton and corn acres are treated, and a majority of our soybean acres are treated with a neonicotinoid seed treatment. They do have efficacy on pests, but they are highly toxic to bees. Bees can be poisoned by them. Bees aren't necessarily any more toxic or any more susceptible to pesticides as a group as many other taxa, but they do tend to be a little bit, not dramatically, but a little bit more sensitive to the neonicotinoids than some other taxa. Now, one of the big concerns is these neonics have systemic activity, so there's possibility of the exposure through translocation to pollen and nectar that the bees may forage on. Now, the EPA has defined what they call levels of concern. You can think of these as LD10s. For bees that are foraging on crops, and that level for nectar, foraging on nectar, is pretty low. It's about 4 to 6 parts per billion. In pollen, it's considerably higher, more like 150 to 200 parts per billion, and that's simply a function of how much of that resource the bees feed on. One of the big things that we're struggling with, really nationally, and the EPA is struggling with, that I'm not going to address, is the effect of chronic sublethal effects on honeybees and other pollinators. Now, there is considerable debate on this issue. There's even debate about whether colony collapse disorder is really causing a decline in bee populations, whether it's a new event. You can see it's kind of described in 2006, and if you look at the bee colony numbers in the U.S. since that time, they're really pretty stable. And worldwide, they've increased. There's a lot of social media and activists involved in this, and really the neonics were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They're coming up through re-registration review, and they kind of became a target of this. And there's a lot, we have to take some credit in the scientific world because there's some good science out there, but there's some junk science out there and a lot of agenda-driven science that is driving things. So depending on what you believe and what you want to believe, you can read anything you want, and it may be the case is solved, neonics are the problem, or there's some considerable debate still in the scientific community. But regardless of what the science says now and is going to say, this is an issue that is going to affect everybody in this room, and particularly consultants, the way they do their job, and the research and extension people. We're going to see label changes, we already have, loss of products, delays in registrations of new products, increased record-keeping requirements, and I think we're going down the road where we're talking about prescription application. We've already seen a ban of these products, at least temporarily, in parts of Europe. The EPA just finished a needs assessment for the value of soybean neonicotinoid seed treatments in soybean, and they concluded there's really not any value. And make no mistake, this is really the first step towards trying to eliminate the use of that product in soybean. So beginning about a few years ago, we got our heads out of the sand and said, you know, this is an issue that's going to affect us in the room, and we need to start doing some work. And so we collectively started working on this, and all the people on this slide have been involved in the research. You're going to see at some level or another. I call them the B team, and my wife always says, well, if you guys try a little harder, you can be the A team. But I always thought that funny. But it involves people at the university and also USDA, who's been collaborating and providing financial support. And really the question we're trying to answer is, are these neonics really the major factor contributing, or a major player contributing to CCD, or are they a minor player? Now, when we started this, really the big thing that was in the press was this talc dust being being emitted from planters, vacuum planters, was drifting all over the countryside. This poison clouds were poisoning everything. That's kind of how it was being portrayed in the media. And frankly, we were pretty skeptical. But we started doing some research, and this research has been published since. And lo and behold, what we found by randomly sampling around the perimeter of various fields, cotton, corn, and soybean, is that, yeah, occasionally we did find neonicotinoids on wildflowers around recently planted fields. Most of the time we didn't, but about 25% of the samples we did, on average it was about 10 parts per billion. Now, one thing we still don't know is what that means. We don't know how that affects bee mortality, pollinator health, and we really don't know how long that persists after planting. You know, is it gone with the rainfall? All our samples were taken very shortly after planting. These products do have longevity. They have longevity in the soil. It varies considerably depending on the soil type and the environmental conditions. But we took samples of fields prior to planting, and what we found is we were detecting neonicotinoids that had been used the previous year, you know, potentially maybe 2 years before. Not at real high levels, average about 10 parts per billion, but it ranged from 0 to 40 parts per billion, so they can persist. Now, if you look in the middle of the season when these plants are beginning to flower, and in this case we're looking at a cotton example, those concentrations in the soil are considerably higher. It varies considerably, again, depending on soil and rainfall and the insecticide itself, but we had concentrations during early flowering in cotton. In some cases, it ranged up to several hundred parts per billion. So the real question is, how much of that is biologically available? Is it really available? Is it bound to the soil? And how do concentrations relate to plant concentrations and ultimately bee mortality? Now, I can tell you, and you'll see on the next slide, that these concentrations don't relate necessarily really well to what you're actually seeing in the plants or in nectar and pollen. And that's because when we collected these soil samples, we simultaneously collected cotton nectar and cotton pollen and soybean flowers and corn pollen to see what those concentrations were. And that's where I think we have some good news, because what we found is there was actually very little neonicotinoids found in those flowering structures. We didn't find any neonicotinoids in nectar of cotton, and on average, less than our level of limit of detection of one part per billion in pollen. In the multiple test in soybeans, we did not find any neonicotinoids from any of the seed treatments we evaluated, which was all of the commercially available ones. We did find neonicotinoids in corn pollen that had been reported, and actually the levels we found are pretty similar. Not so much thiamethoxam, but the high rate of clofianidin 1250, we had averaged about 6 parts per billion of clofianidin in corn pollen that had been treated with a Poncho 1250 rate. We also, at the same time, were surveying, essentially sampling apiaries are in ag-intensive areas, and we sampled bees and the pollen they were carrying. And that was pretty much good news, too. For the most part, we sampled 60 different hives. We found very low levels on average, less than the limit of detection. We did have a couple of exceptions. We had a couple of hives that had, one had 10 parts per billion. The bees were contaminated at that level with clofianidin, and one up to 48 parts per billion imidacloprid, which we pretty much think came from a foliar application contamination. And that's enough to potentially cause some impact on bee health. We didn't find any in bee pollen. So what else have we been doing since then? And that's what I want to spend the rest of my presentation time on. We've really been trying to nail down the wind issue, the drift issue, and I think this is an issue we're ultimately going to solve with engineering and filtering out vacuum planters, making sure we're not making a dust cloud. Angus Catchout has a graduate student, Adam Whalen. This is some data they've generated in Mississippi where they planted corn treated with clofianidin. I think this is clofianidin 500. And what you're looking at here is the percent detection, and on the bars you can actually see the level of detection that they found downwind of that planter. And lo and behold, it kind of confirmed what we saw in our previous study. We are detecting movement up to 100 meters away. And keep in mind, they're not planting a whole field here. They're just planting, I don't know, 8 or 10 or 12 rows. So if you're planting a whole field, you can see where these numbers might go higher. This is a similar test in soybean where we planted no-till soybean. We planted 176 rows that were 15-inch rows that was treated with Cruiser. And lo and behold, we could detect a gradient essentially downwind of that dust that had been moved. And what we were doing is putting potted plants downwind at known distances. And this is a similar experiment Gus Lorenz did. He did it around the downwind side of planted fields in Arkansas in 2013, and he did cotton, soybean, and corn fields. And this is again showing you the percent detection of neonicotinoids in those samples. Now, compared to our previous year, we're up from 25%. We're more like 50% on average across these crops because he focused on the downwind side. So I think that makes perfect sense. Now, one of the things we want to do, I guess, to get a little bit of reflection and see what these numbers mean. What does it mean when you find 2 parts per billion in pollen or 6 parts per billion in corn? We did seasonal profiles of expression, and this is an example. Keep in mind, I'm not showing you all our data. This is a data set from Tennessee where we're looking at clothianidin concentrations from either Poncho 250, Poncho 500, or Poncho 1250, and we're looking at time from early emergence all the way up through flowering or tasseling. And the point I want to make here is during that seedling stage, we have very high concentrations, hundreds or thousands of parts per million. By the time we're getting to that flowering stage where bees might be foraging on pollen, in this case, we're over a 97% reduction in the concentration of clothianidin. The reduction's even more dramatic when you get into other crops. And again, I'm just showing you some of the data. This is an example, I think, Jeff Gore's data set in Mississippi where you're looking at an aniseed treatment, so imidacloprid. You're looking at imidacloprid and its metabolites. And again, during that early seedling stage, we're talking hundreds of parts per billion. Some of my data show them thousands of parts per billion. By the time we get to first flower, we're at 2.5 parts per billion. That's over a 99% reduction. And a data set from Angus Catchout in Mississippi, looking at soybean with the Cruiser thiamethoxam seed treatment. At cotyledon stage, over 7,000 parts per billion of clothianidin or thiamethoxam or its metabolites. And by the way, clothianidin is a metabolite of thiamethoxam, but virtually nothing, 1 part per billion at R1. So I think this provides a lot of context. You know, if we're losing insect efficacy in cotton at the third leaf stage and we're at hundreds and thousands of parts per billion, it doesn't seem very likely to me that 1 part per billion a month down the road is probably having any significant measurable effect on bees. And I think, again, it gives us some context. We're doing a little bit now. We're expanding, looking at foliar applications because, I think that's a more likely route of exposure. And this is just an example of that. This is a test we did in Tennessee in 2014 where I sprayed full label rates of Admire Pro and Centric. And then we followed up at different intervals after that application and we collected cotton blooms, fresh cotton blooms, and pulled the pollen out of them and had them tested for neonicotinoid concentration. And as you can see on the left graph, that's the imidacloprid or Admire Pro. First day after we sprayed, we had concentrations that averaged about 30 parts per billion. I don't think that's very surprising. It's not a particularly large number if you consider that EPA level of concern for pollen was like 170. So we're not there. And then it decreased rapidly. And then when you look at the right, you're looking at thiamethoxam or the Cruiser application. And I think the good news here is we are seeing a spike occurring in the pollen, but it diminishes. It's not a real high spike, and it diminishes by 4, 5, 6 days after application, so we're not getting a real prolonged concentration occurring in the pollen. But we do need some more data on this. We're also doing some more work with bees, trying to work with the bees themselves and looking at how agriculture is affecting the health of hives. Adam Whalum, again, Angus Catchout's graduate student, is working on some bee foraging behavior. Some of us contributed data to this. I'm just going to show a couple slides to make a point. We did some data, collected some data to try to see where are these bees spending their time. Well, given a choice, they spend most of their time in soybean. They prefer soybean over cotton. They spend very little time in corn, but I've seen heavy foraging in corn. But the one thing about corn is it's only really a suitable host for a very short period of time during pollination, whereas soybean and cotton bloom for an extended period of time, so there's much more risk of exposure. And so this is something to keep in mind. If we're spraying soybean that's blooming and it's a sensitive area, we got apiaries around it, we can mitigate some of that effect potentially by spraying at night. Or not at night necessarily, but later in the day. And this is some more data to reinforce that, again, from the same study, looking at when bees are active in these fields, and this is across all these crops. And as the literature would have suggested, by the time we get to early evening, bee activity, foraging activity decreases sharply. So again, this is something we can take advantage of in sensitive areas. I always use sorghum as a good example because sorghum's very sensitive or very attractive to honeybees, and a lot of times we have to spray it during flowering for midge. This is something that if we have a lot of bees present, we can maybe target later in the day and really mitigate some effects. Now, one of the things we're doing in Tennessee and in Arkansas is we're putting out beehives in agricultural areas and non-agricultural areas, and we're trying to monitor hive health. And we've just started this initiative and really don't have a lot of good data on how that's affecting hive health, but we have collected some other data. This is the only data we got the results back from the lab on, and it's four hives from Arkansas. So he's got a high egg area, Pettus, and a low egg area, Spradley. Am I saying that right? Thank you, guys. And we've collected samples from there. Bees, bee pupae, pollen, and wax. And we've done an assay to see what pesticides are present in those, not necessarily just neonicotinoids. First thing I point out in the slide, the biggest bars you see on those graphs are in the wax, and it's miticides used for bromide. It's Cumafos and fluvalinate. That's kind of interesting because we didn't use those products. They had not been treated. This came in on the foundation wax of the hives. And in fact, there's bifenthrin in both the egg, high egg, and low egg area at about the same level. I suspect that may have came in somehow on the wax. The wax was contaminated. Now, the other thing that shows up in the high egg area, we are detecting some cyhalothrin, karate, lambda-cyhalothrin, azoxystrobin, which is Quadris, and tebuconazole in the pollen. So we are seeing some impact of the egg and some of those chemistries or chemicals showing up in the pollen. Did not see that in the low egg area. It'll be interesting to see how it turns out in Tennessee. Now, the one thing I didn't mention, we didn't detect any neonicotinoids. And what's really interesting about that is part of this protocol, two hives at each location were being treated with a sublethal dose of imidacloprid, that 5 parts per billion that I mentioned earlier as a level of concern. They were fed several times during the season, and it didn't even show up. So that's very interesting and I think encouraging. So I want to spend my last 2 or 3 minutes just talking about the impact of this. You know, the labels now, almost all the labels you look at them, if the pesticide is considered acutely toxic to bees, it says you cannot use this product when bees are actively foraging, when bees are present in the field, unless you meet one of these criterion. And I stole this slide from our Jeff Gore. And the criterions are this. First of all, you can make the application after sunset. Well, we know we can't spray every field after sunset. We know there's limitations. We know there's safety issues. So that's not necessarily a viable option in all cases or most cases even. The application can be made if it's below 55 because bees aren't active when it's below 55. I'll skip the next one because it has to do more with public health. And the other one is that allows us to make these applications is that the application can be made if there's an imminent threat of significant crop loss, essentially conforming to a threshold. You broke a threshold, you can make an application. And there's still a requirement in there that you must notify beekeepers no less than, make every effort to notify beekeepers no less than 48 hours before application. That's a significant limitation, and it's not very clear. Beekeepers in the county, beekeepers in the neighboring area, you know, how far do you go? So that poses a real issue that we may face down the road, we're facing right now. One of the things we're trying to do, honestly, is reduce regulation because the things that come down from the federal level may not be helpful to us or the beekeepers necessarily. There can be some negative consequences. So all the states in the Mid-South and several states really across the nation are starting to promote a bee awareness or a bee stewardship program. And really this is just a voluntary agreement between stakeholder groups like beekeepers, growers, applicators, and consultants to communicate, to locate hives, GPS them, let the applicators know where they are, fill in the ground crew, try not to spray when the wind's blowing towards the hives. It's just about communication and cooperation. And you know, honestly, the EPA would like us to do this because they don't really have the resources or the time to invest and do this. But they are holding our, the fire to our feet and saying, it's got to be done right. We've got to have a good plan, and a lot of us in various stages of implementing these stewardship programs. I'm gonna quit right there, but I would encourage everybody to remain active on this issue. You know, you need to be informed and inform people about it. Let's not create any problems unnecessarily by making mistakes, but we also need to talk to our growers and our constituents and make sure they're aware of it. I do want to acknowledge the funding. We got a lot of funding from commodity groups, so the growers, and we also got funding from USDA, ARS, and then we thank some of the beekeepers we worked with, all the beekeepers we worked with in Tennessee and Arkansas. I think I'm got 8 seconds, so I don't know if you want to field a question or not.
We got time for one question, if anybody's got a question.
I appreciate everybody's attention.
You overwhelmed everybody.